Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week, I'm taking you backstage in a world disrupted. We feature interviews with leaders in Washington and around the globe who can help us understand an international world that can seem like it's spinning out of control. Join me every Monday for new episodes. Subscribe, rate us, write a written review on Apple Podcasts or whatever your preferred podcast platform. And you can always email me at sglasser@politico.com. And now, to today's show. Well, hi, I'm Susan Glasser, and welcome to the Global Politico. This is our first edition in 2018. I have to thank all of you for being our listeners in 2017. We were recently got this great shout-out from Quartz as the best politics podcast of the year, and I feel like, I don't know if that's true or not, but I know that we do have the best audience, and we've certainly had a lot of the best guests. And I'm delighted that our first guest this year will be on really the first big breaking international news story of the year, which is this surprising eruption of protests across Iran in the very first week of 2018, the very last week of 2017. We're here a little bit more than a week into those protests, and we are going to have a conversation today with two people who've spent really their adult lives thinking about this question of change and when will it come, if ever, to the Islamic Republic. Suzanne Maloney joins me here. She is one of Washington's premier Iran experts, deputy director of the Brookings Middle East program. She's worked inside the State Department advising on the question of Iran from 2005 to 2007. She worked at ExxonMobil looking at how Iran affects the question of Middle East and gas and oil politics. And she's an author. She's a very thoughtful observer of our episodic and raging Iran policy debates here in Washington. And we're particularly lucky that we're joined as well by Maziar Bahari, who is a leading Iranian-Canadian journalist, filmmaker, documentarian, author. For those of you who are not familiar with it, his book, Then They Came For Me, recounts an extraordinary story that we're going to talk about in this podcast of his own experience covering the 2009 Green Movement, being arrested by the Iranian government, his own tale of torture and adversity in surviving that experience, leaving Iran, and continuing not only to report and write about it, but to help found a group called Iran Wire, which has now become one of the indispensable conduits of information from inside Iran. We're very lucky that he joins us today as well, visiting from London, where you're based now. So without further ado, are we having an after-action report on these protests, or is it an ongoing movement? What do you guys think?
Actually, as you were introducing me, I was reading an email. Maybe it's not a very polite thing to do, but I was reading an email about from someone within Iran, from the city of Sari, who said that north of Iran, he said that he or she, actually, I don't know, said that they've been protesting on the first day and second day. And after the third day, the security forces took over the city, so they could not come out and protest. But the person who sent the email said that I'm just going out now because there's less security and we're going to demonstrate and please report about what we're doing. So this shows that the regime, the Iranian government, might be able to suppress the protest for a few days, maybe a few weeks, a few months, or even a few years through allocating security forces, government resources to suppressing people's protests. But the cause of these protests, unemployment, corruption, the ineffectual Islamic system that has been around for the past 40 years, these will not go away. And as a result, people will come to the streets and demonstrate anytime there is a measure of space.
So, Suzanne, we're here in Washington, and once again, actually, the timing is fascinating of these protests erupting right as there's also about to be a major moment of decision for the Trump administration next week, over the coming week, as to whether to continue forward with his policy of basically attacking the Iran nuclear deal. How do you think the protests will affect that decision?
Well, it's an interesting confluence. Trump came into office, obviously, highlighting Iran and seeking to move U.S. policy in a more confrontational direction. He took the first step in that way in October when he announced that he would no longer certify Iran's compliance with the nuclear deal. The real test comes this week with the sanctions waivers that are due. If Trump does not extend those waivers, we will fall out of compliance ourselves with the Iran nuclear deal. We will effectively be walking away from that agreement. My sense is that what's happening inside Iran plays directly into the narrative that consumes at least those who are advising Trump, which is that one can't do transactions with an inherently evil entity. And that fundamentally, the problem is not about the nuclear program or about Iran's involvement in Syria or other places in the region. Fundamentally, the problem is the nature of the regime. And so to the extent that the president hears that view echoed from Iranians on the streets, it may harden his perception and potentially tempt him to take very disruptive action. I think it would be a big mistake, but that will be something that we'll have to contend with.
Well, you know, one thing somebody said to me who spent a long time thinking a lot about Iran and U.S. policy toward it, I asked him that same question. What do you think is going to happen next week with President Trump? And he emailed me back. He said, you know, predicting President Trump's foreign policy actions requires a lot more humility than even predicting what's going to happen in the Middle East. So I want to pull back, though, before we jump right into today's policy debates, because this question of how do we even know what's going on inside of Iran? Both of you have devoted your professional lives, Maziar, at enormous personal cost. You've made the decision to try to help the world understand what's happening in your native country. You know, you guys have an amazing story, too. It's not easy to be an Iran expert in one of the world's most repressive and isolated countries. You were telling me before you walked in.
It's easy to be an Iran expert. It's very difficult to be a good one, like Suzanne.
Well, look, I mean, first of all, right, these protests are a surprise to everybody, as far as we can tell. You didn't predict them. As far as we
no
know, they're
Iranian.
Yeah, no one predicted them. So you two met not far from here on September 11th, 2001. You were both already thinking about this question of change and when and how it will come to Iran. How much is the world shaped by what happened that day? And tell me a little bit about your own friendship and knowledge of each other.
Well, actually, I think it was in year 2000 when I read an article about different devious people in the U.S., in Washington, who run American foreign policy against Iran, and Suzanne was one of them.
Oh.
So naturally,
I thought, you know, this is a good person to talk to.
Hey, you want to know the devious
exactly
people.
I wanted to know all the devious people. And I think I emailed Suzanne, and she kindly accepted to meet me. And we were supposed to meet, yes, at Kramer's in DuPont Circle in Washington. And we were supposed to have lunch. But then, of course, I was coming with a train from Baltimore. My brother used to live there. And then, you know, we heard about what happened in New York. We still managed to meet, and we still, you know, had a conversation about Iran. We didn't know who was behind the attacks, of course. And we've been in touch for the past 16 years, and a lot has happened, of course. One of the things that happened in Iran is the failure of the reform movement that we were all really hopeful at that time because we had a reformist, pro-reform president in 1997 in Iran, and there were some reforms happening in the country. But then the reforms failed, and then, of course, Ahmadinejad came to power in 2005, and then we had the crackdown in 2009, which led to my incarceration. And I think what I like about Suzanne's approach to Iran is that she's not ideological, unlike most quote-unquote Iran experts who I know in Washington. And most of the times reading Suzanne's articles or her excellent books, people come up with more questions than answers, which I think is a good thing because Iran is a very complicated country with a very complicated history and a very complicated government structure. So anyone who is providing you simple, easy answers to this is fraud, and it's a lie. But I think what's good about Suzanne's work is that it's very complicated, and you see the complexity of Iran in her work.
Well, you know, I have to say, Mazyar, you've just summed up, actually, Washington policy debates in a nutshell, right? Ideological and tending to simplify in order to amplify those ideological points. And I think Iran is probably one of the most notable aspects of that. I mean, Suzanne, first of all, do you remember that 9/11 conversation?
Oh, sure. It was a kind of a surreal moment to kind of make my way into down into D.C. at a time where people were already beginning to stream out of the city, and to sit and have lunch really as everything was beginning to shut down because there was still so much uncertainty about what was happening. I think the original intent of our meeting was to talk about what would happen with the Bush administration's policy toward Iran, George W. Bush. Would he, in fact, take a tough approach, or was it possible that sanctions and other opportunities might come open? And, you know, as you could see the smoke rising from the Pentagon, it was clear that everything had changed as of that moment. And I think in many respects, our policy toward Iran has been very much impacted by the post-9/11 environment, the focus on terrorism, the new authorities that the U.S. government and the president in particular acquired as a result of that attack, and the clear need to address the threat of terrorist financing. That was a big part of the story that helped bring about the first really strenuous multilateral sanctions on Iran during the Obama administration, and then, of course, the negotiations that led to the 2015 nuclear deal.
Well, that's right. It's interesting, you know, many policy fights in Washington, right, they tend to have sort of their historical antecedents. The one that we're fighting over, it seems like these days at the beginning of 2018 and this new round of protests, is what happened in the beginning of the Obama administration and this last very significant round of protests in 2009. Both of you have a really unique perspective on that. We've had a huge fight in recent days. You've had the Vice President of the United States, Michael Pence, write an op-ed in the New York Times, the basic point of which was Barack Obama was wrong not to have more full-throatedly supported this protest back then. And that's the Trump administration policy. We're not going to make that same mistake again. Both of you have very interesting things to say about that. Suzanne, you had, I don't know if you're normally a tweet stormer, but you had a very interesting Twitter storm around that very question. And, you know, this being Washington, one of the great things is that we have experts, you know, who live in the midst of everyday lives. You know, you can't be really an Iran think tank policy expert in many parts of America. But you and your husband both devote your lives to this. And you tweeted, well, we're having a big debate in my household over whether President Trump should speak out more forcefully here, and clearly colored by what happened back in 2009.
Yeah. And I think for me, you know, I have feel as though there have been real lessons learned since 2009. And so as someone who defended the Obama administration's decision to effectively avoid implicating the United States in the protests that emerged in the aftermath of the contested reelection of then-President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, it seemed defensible to me at the time, given the focus and the clear need to try to arrive at some kind of a diplomatic resolution on the nuclear issue, but also because I was steeped in what I think has become conventional wisdom that anything that we do from the United States government perspective that in any way associates Iranian oppositionists and dissidents with us will ultimately hurt them. But I will say I've heard from many of those who were part of that movement, many of those who continue to push for human rights and other advocacy in Iran that, in fact, the United States standing back is not an asset. They're going to be tainted. They're going to be accused of being American stooges no matter what they do. And so for the president of the United States to stand on the side on the sidelines at a key moment in history is really abdicating the responsibility. And I think it's also clear that Obama's reticence at that time didn't really advance his diplomatic options on the nuclear deal. It didn't really open up any space. There wasn't really much progress for a couple of additional years, and it took a lot of other factors to bring about the negotiations that took place in 2013. So I think there's really no justification now for avoiding full-throated advocacy on behalf of those who are expressing themselves, and a very clear message from not just Washington, but ideally the rest of the international community, that a crackdown, violence against those who are peacefully demonstrating will have real consequences for Iran.
So, Maziar, does that mean that Donald Trump is getting it right where Barack Obama was wrong?
I think the president is right. You know, when you talked about Mike Pence, all of a sudden I became uncomfortable because I'm in a room with two women who are not my wives alone. So,
Three, actually, with Bridget, our producer.
And Bridget, yeah. So three women. So that made me uncomfortable. But whether we like Mike Pence or not, whether we like Donald Trump or not, they are president and vice president of the United States. And as such, Iranian protesters, Iranian people like to hear from them. I remember being in the streets of Tehran in 2009 when millions of people came to the streets and were silent, were demonstrating peacefully, and they wanted their votes to be counted. And they really wanted their silence to be heard by the international community. And it was really disappointing for them not to hear from President Obama at that time.
And they mentioned that to you when you were
They mentioned that to me. And also, you have to remember that the Iranian government, being anti-American is in the DNA of the Iranian government. So whoever is critical of the Iranian government is being accused of being a stooge of America. So whether the Americans are quiet or vocal or screaming, it doesn't matter. They're going to accuse the opponents and even the critics of the Islamic Republic of being stooges of Americans and Israelis and the British. And so right now, President Trump has tweeted five or six times supporting the recent protests in Iran. I wish the tweets were a bit more nuanced and more, you know, deep. But it's very difficult to expect everything, of course, and especially in 140 characters or now 280 characters. So I think he did the right thing. And I think people of Iran, Iranian protesters love to hear from President Trump, Vice President Pence, different officials in the United States. And also, as Suzanne said, from different people in the international community, because at the end of the day, the Iranian people, young Iranians who've come to the streets, are the best allies of the United States.
Well, so let's talk about your experience back in 2009, because it is relevant to what we're seeing today. And how is it different? How is it similar? Why did it fail back then? What are the prospects for change or reform now? So in 2009, going to your point about the anti-Western, anti-American sentiment that's in the DNA of the government, when you were arrested, it eventually became clear that that was part of the effort, was to connect you, as they were looking for you to help them establish that this was part of a plot by the West. What was it like?
I think, again, we have to always talk about history, because it's very difficult to talk about one point in time about Iran without talking about history. The Islamic Republic came to power after the Islamic Republic government came to power after the 1979 revolution, which was an anti-foreign intervention. We can say even a xenophobic revolution in a sense, people of Iran were tired of years of intervention by different powers in the country, and especially during the 1979 revolution, they could see the close relationship between the Shah and the United States. So death to America became as much of a chant during the revolution as death to America. So the regime is built on this anti-American sentiment. And after 3 decades of being in power in 2009, many people in Iran became disenchanted with the government. Many people became critical of the government. Many people within the Iranian government became critical of the Iranian government, of the system. And because of that, those people were looked at. I don't think that they were fabricating what they were saying, but they genuinely believed that the people who were critical of the Supreme Leader of Iran, Ayatollah Khamenei, and the revolution as a whole were agents of the West. And because of that, they tried to concoct the scenario to create a connection between the protesters on the streets, the critics of the regime on one side, and foreigners. And for that, they needed certain people who were in Iran at the time and working with foreign institutions. So they arrested someone who was working with George Soros' Open Society Institute, Kian Tajbakhsh. They arrested someone else who was advising the British Embassy at that time, Hossein Rassam. And they also arrested me, I was working for Newsweek at the time. And all the interrogations that we went through, all the torture that we went through, was to prove this scenario that the Revolutionary Guards, who were the people who arrested us, had in their head, to concoct to this scenario that, yes, some of the reformist critics of the regime are in touch with the foreigners. So when I was being tortured in Evin prison in Iran, as a cell not very actually dissimilar to the room, to the studio, to the dark studio we are in, I was being asked about how did I put certain reformist official in touch with the British embassy or with an American diplomat. And to them, it didn't matter really that I was lying. They believed that at the end of the day, maybe not me, but someone like me had put them in touch, had put those reformers in touch with foreign powers. And they wanted to prove that. And that's why I went through a lot of pressure in order to come to on television and say that, yes, I put that person in touch with someone else. So in 2009, that was the scenario that they had, and there was a clear demonstration with a clear objective that people wanted their votes to be counted, and there were three figureheads for that demonstration, and all those three figureheads were among the people who were within the regime. This time around, we see leaderless protests all across Iran by people who are very young, very poor, and they come from cities where there was no demonstration in 2009.
Right. It's a very different basis. You very saw a much basis. More kind of like urban, middle
cultivated,
class.
Cultivated, educated. And that's why it was so easy for Westerners to understand demonstrators in 2009, because they could go to the streets and have a conversation with them in English, and they had English signs in their hands, and they could, you know, communicate. And many of them were people who had lived in the West before, and they knew how the media and how the system works. But this time around, it was a more grassroots movement. It was more, it's been more spontaneous, because I don't think that the demonstrations have ended. There is a bit of a lull, but I think the demonstrations will go on in the next few days at least. And this series of demonstrations in Iran, which is started on December 28, 2017, they have puzzled everyone in Iran and outside of Iran. It has even puzzled the Revolutionary Guards. It has even puzzled people who are very much in touch with the poor in Iran, because they could not see this desperation among people. They could not see that they could not foresee that many people could come to the streets, risk their lives, and chant slogans, which is against the system.
Well, Maziar, people, it's interesting. You can see this confusion almost in how the government hasn't had a quick unified line responding to them. And so some of the default anti-Americanism has kicked in. They have blamed it on outside interference or Western disruption. But I don't think, unlike in 2009, when they sort of dragged you out of your mother's home, and they clearly already had something in mind that they wanted to make you confess to. I don't see that yet.
No, and the difference between now and 2009 is that even before the demonstrations started in 2009, the Revolutionary Guards and different intelligence apparatus in Iran, they had a scenario. It was not a very good scenario, but they had a scenario about what's going on and who are the people behind these demonstrations. This time around, I think they're concocting a scenario as we speak here that, you know, that's why you hear different voices inside Iran. Some of them, they blame Americans. Some of them, they blame Israelis, Saudis. Some of them, they blame even former President Ahmadinejad, who talked about people's economic situation a few weeks ago. So I think at the moment, the regime is just struggling to suppress the protest. But it will be very interesting to see how are they going to address the core cause of this demonstration and whether they will be wise enough in order to allocate some resources, some effort in order to understand what were the causes behind this series of protests recently.
And now, a word from a sponsor.
So, Suzanne, this brings us right to the question that we're often stuck with, which is not only what to make of what's going on inside Iran and did we get it right, did we get it wrong, but what role is Washington playing in affecting events and outcomes on the ground? You know, we talked a little bit about 2009 and the Obama decision not to really aggressively intervene. How much is the Iran nuclear deal today a factor in all this? How much could Donald Trump affect things on the ground one way or the other? I mean, one thing I think many of us expected for 2018 was that Iran would be a significant focus of the foreign policy debates here in Washington. Now we're starting out perhaps even sooner than we thought. But what do you think? It's a pretty hawkish group of advisors on this subject that the president has assembled. How do you read what they're doing?
Well, I think we have to be careful to give the United States too much, if any, credit in terms of shaping political outcomes within Iran. There is a temptation among both Americans and often some Iranians to sort of look to Washington and say, well, if only Washington had done this policy or had not done that, taken that step, that perhaps the reformist movement might have succeeded, perhaps Ahmadinejad wouldn't have been elected, perhaps some other outcome would have happened. I think overwhelmingly, Iranian politics are shaped by events inside Iran and by actors inside Iran. And there are times where the voice of the White House and the actions of the United States government have some broader impact on the context, but they don't necessarily, I think, pick winners and losers, and I'm sure that we would have no capacity to do that in the current circumstances. I think where the nuclear deal comes into play with respect to the current unrest in Iran is possibly, and I say possibly because, you know, we're still trying to understand who, what, where, why, and when about these protests, but the nuclear deal may well have contributed to raising expectations among Iranians about the prospects for a steady improvement in the economy that would trickle down in a way that prior efforts to both reform and rebuild and grow the economy have not. And that perhaps what is happening is some bubbling up of frustration from people who've watched this movie before. They saw the opening after the Iran-Iraq War by former President Rafsanjani. They saw the reform movement engage in a dialogue of civilizations and improve Iran's image in the world and bring in new trade and investment. They saw Ahmadinejad's populist promises and then Rouhani's diplomatic promises. And fundamentally, their lives haven't improved. And some of what I think we're seeing on the streets is a reaction to that, the sense of growing inequality, the sense of frustration with promises that are never kept, promises that are fundamental to the legitimacy of the Islamic Republic.
What about here in Washington, though? I mean, has there been any recognition, do you think, or more humility about our ability to influence events on the ground? You worked inside the government at a very interesting period of time. This was, of course, after President Bush had long since made his famous declaration about Iran as part of the axis of evil. But there was a lot of talk even then around the question of regime change inside Iran and how much the United States could affect that outcome or should attempt to do so. Are we more humble about what we can do there?
We never learn the lesson. And I say that on behalf of all of us in Washington, including those of us who try to remember the mistakes of the past. But we are persistently surprised by developments in Iran. The United States government, for the most part, didn't anticipate the revolution, didn't anticipate any of the other major episodes of Iranian history and politics, the reform movement. I was in government at the time of the Ahmadinejad election, and I engaged in a sort of furious, tearful battle to put forward an analysis to the secretary that predicted an Ahmadinejad win. But that didn't comport with the preconceived narrative that others in the administration had about what was happening inside Iran. And I think that's the difficulty that we have. And frankly, it extends to those of us who speak the language or who've had an opportunity to go to Iran. We all have this sort of frame, and the frame that many on both sides of the aisle here in Washington have had for some time is that Iran is fundamentally a stable place, that Iranians prefer evolution to revolution. They want democracy, they want change, but they're not willing to risk their lives and livelihoods on the streets. That may in fact characterize well the majority of Iranians, but it certainly doesn't characterize the thousands who've gone to the streets over the course of the past few days. So humility is something we all have to keep in mind with respect to Iran.
So that's a great point. I see Maziar nodding his head. I want to get to him. But Suzanne, how would you characterize up until now the Trump approach to Iran? It seems to me they have been more focused not on internal change or reform or revolution inside Iran, but focused on the regional narrative of the very aggressive role Iran has taken in conflicts in Syria, in Yemen. President Trump, as we all know, has openly tilted U.S. policy towards Saudi Arabia, perhaps Iran's biggest regional enemy. There's been a lot of hawkish talk, although I was trying to think about that before this conversation. I'm not sure if I could tell you what exactly the policy was beyond infighting over the future of the Iran deal. How would you characterize what we've seen so far?
Well, I think what we have in the Trump administration is a constellation of cabinet officials and senior White House officials and others around the administration who see Iran through the lens of the U.S. experience in Iraq and Afghanistan, who have firsthand familiarity with the lethality of Iranian involvement in both of those conflicts.
Talking about H.R. McMaster fighting on the ground as a general, talking about General Mattis in the Pentagon.
Yeah, this is, I think, their primary frame of reference for Iran. And so, you know, this, I think, was part of their skepticism toward the nuclear deal that almost transcended the terms and transcended the specific criticisms that people had about sunset clauses or levels of enrichment, that fundamentally their belief seems to be that this is a regime that one can't do business with because ultimately they understand one thing and one thing only, and that is the use of force. And I've heard that from a range of people around town within the administration. It certainly frames the view, but it hasn't yet translated to a significantly stepped up tempo of U.S. activities to try to push back Iran across the region. And I think that's where the president's own fixation on the nuclear deal comes into play. He, of course, wrote the art of the deal. I think he perceives himself as an ultimate deal maker. And so while his cabinet may, in fact, be itching for more of a fight with the Iranians in Syria, Yemen, and elsewhere, the president has sought to approach Iran through the lens of the nuclear deal. And in effect, it's
which
not
is called
a terribly,
the worst deal ever.
Right. And it's not a terribly effective way to go about pushing back on Iran or putting pressure on Iran, because fundamentally it isolates the United States, it puts us at odds with our allies, and it could conceivably put us back in a position of having to worry about short-term prospects for Iranian nuclear weapons capability, something that the deal had deferred for at least 8 to 10 years.
A lot of people have looked at Trump's sort of split-the-difference approach up until now, basically calling it the worst deal ever, refusing to decertify, but at the same time not actually withdrawing from the Iran nuclear deal, as an example of a kind of the emerging Trump foreign policy approach, which is basically he has this sort of outrageous position, but he has these advisors who work. He has people, allies on Capitol Hill, like Bob Corker, who was broken with him, but not on this subject, and Tom Cotton, working to constrain him to come up with a reasonable policy out of something that seems very inflammatory and explosive. But really, he's just sort of bought time, right? He hasn't really resolved that. I mean, and next week, a little bit, the bill comes due for buying time, right?
Well, I think this is the question. Will Trump actually pull the trigger and take the U.S. out of the nuclear deal, fail to comply with our obligations under the nuclear deal? My own guess is no. But the current circumstances are only likely to harden his view of the need. Yeah.
So, Maziar, it must be infuriating and frustrating to watch these debates play out in Washington with only occasional reference to what's actually happening in Iran. What do we screw up the most here in Washington? What do your friends inside Iran think that we get wrong?
Well, I think the debate about Iran in Washington somehow, in certain parts in Washington, mirrors what is the debate about the U.S. in Iran. And the fact is that for the many politicians in the U.S., the target audience are their constituents in different parts of the United States. And they, first and foremost, they want to make those, the people who vote for them, happy. And it's the same thing in Iran, that many of their rhetorics, many of the actions of the Iranian government in terms of foreign policy, the target audience are the people inside Iran. And because of that, mistakes happen. I've been in Washington in the past couple of days, and I've met different people within the government, different think tanks, and different journalists. And I think because of the confusion about these protests, because of the search for an answer, the answer to who is behind the protest and what is going on, the conversation in the past couple of days at least is more nuanced than I've seen before, because in the past it was more black and white, that some people, they wanted regime change. Some people said that, no, the regime is too strong and we have to work with it and we can never change this regime. So I think it's a positive development that the conversation has become more nuanced. But I think one thing that the United States has to do, and it is in the long-term interest of the United States, Iran, and the region, is to condemn violence. Condemn violence by the regime, of course, against its own people, against peaceful protesters, but also the United States, which still has certain moral standing in that part of the world, has to condemn violence against the regime, because there are voices inside the United States, Iranians and Americans, who are inciting violence against banks, against mosques in Iran. And I think those voices have to be condemned by the American government.
So you said the United States still has some moral standing left in the region, you know, obviously after the invasion of Iraq.
And that says more about the governments in those countries than the United States, because when you are in Washington and you compare, I don't know, this administration to Woodrow Wilson's administration, maybe you don't see that moral standing anymore. But when you're in Iran and you look at your leaders who are supposed to be religious, but they lie at you while looking at you, your face, and you know that corruption permeates throughout the country or in other countries in the region, in Saudi Arabia, in Iraq, in Lebanon. people have to deal with corrupt elected officials all the time. So that's why they still see the United States as more moral than their own government.
So they don't have the what's the right word, the Trump effect experience in quite the same way as the people you're talking to here in Washington.
No, because people in this country, in the U.S., of course, talk about sexual harassment, about the Russia investigation, about healthcare reforms, but in Iran, those issues are not relevant to people's daily lives. What they're interested in is, I mean, their economy, their daily bread, of course. And when they come to the streets and they demonstrate against their government, against corruption in their government, they like to hear some support from the rest of the world. And also, one of the things that motivated people in 2009 to come to the streets, and I think motivates people to come to the streets now, is the position of Iran in the world, that Iranians, they're very proud of their civilization. They're proud of their 2,500 years of civilization, and they don't like to be regarded as pariah. And that's why many people, they were just disgusted by Ahmadinejad, former President Ahmadinejad, who denied the Holocaust
and now Trump lumps them in with North Korea once again.
Exactly. And that's why they were, I can say that 99% of the Iranians, they are against the travel ban. They just don't see, of Iranians, they just don't see any reasons behind the travel ban by the United States. But of course, I think they don't understand maybe the narrative that, you know, the President Trump wants to appease his own constituencies. But I don't think I think the travel ban was wrong. And I think in a couple of weeks, when he has to decide about the sanctions and waiving some of the sanctions, he has, I believe that it will be a moral thing to do, right thing to do, to impose sanctions on Iranian television, which is the main propaganda force for this suppressive regime. But also he has to lift the ban in order to be able to communicate better with ordinary Iranians, for ordinary Iranians to trust the American government better.
Yeah, you know, you've mentioned that, Suzanne. You've also publicly said that's the number one thing they could do. But there's no indication, realistically, that Trump has any interest whatsoever in removing Iran from that travel ban, is there?
I don't think so. But, you know, this is Washington. Anything can happen. And, you know, there's been this long-running legal battle over the travel ban. This seems like an opportunity for the president to deal with a policy that hasn't really served his interests. It hasn't really, because it was never properly designed to address a genuine threat of homegrown or domestic terrorism. And it is such an affront to the people of Iran and to the million-plus Iranian-Americans who have been such a major force for good in the United States in all kinds of different ways.
So, you know, it's interesting. We're talking so much about 2009 and these protests, and then, of course, which potentially had a role in inspiring the Arab revolutions, you know, just a couple years later, what we called the Arab Spring, which has not necessarily worked out as many of those who took to the streets expected. Now you have this interesting situation where part of these protests inside Iran might be a backlash to the very expansive role that the government of Iran has taken in responding to the ongoing disruptions across the Arab world, right? You have them stepping in a major way to the Syrian civil war that was a result of that Arab Spring uprising that's still being fought today. You have really a region that has never recovered from the instability and disruption unleashed by that round of protests. Many people had hopes. They really haven't worked out. Do you think people inside Iran are willing to risk so much to appear in the streets? I mean, it's an astonishing thing when you look at the measures that the Assad government, that Iran's own government has been willing to take to crack down. You know, what's to stop them from doing those kinds of things inside Iran itself?
Yeah, that's one of the differences between what happened in 2009 and what is happening now, that the people who came to the streets in 2009, they were mostly educated people in urban areas. And many of them were middle class or lower middle class, and they had something to lose. They were not as desperate as the protesters that we see now, with nothing to lose. I was talking to a very poor family. They were not taking part in demonstrations themselves, but they had a neighbor who was taking part in the demonstrations. And they were talking about absolute poverty, people who have no jobs. They live on a certain amount of money that Imam Khomeini Charity Foundation give them every month. That is not enough for them to live on. And their child goes out, you know, 15, 16-year-old child goes out and protests because he does not like the way his parents live. He has a very good knowledge of the internet. He sees the way that different people live in different parts of the world. And also, these protests now, the protests in different Arab countries, and I refrain to use the word Arab Spring, and what happened in 2009, they're all about agency. They're all about people wanting their voices to be heard. They're all about people realizing that they have rights as citizens of their countries. And the Iranian government does not treat them as citizens of the country. They treat them as subjects of a master, the supreme leader of Iran. And because of that, people use any amount of space to protest and any device in order to get their voices heard by their countrymen and also by the outside world.
So next year will mark 40 years since the Islamic Revolution. Do you think this is the beginning of the end of that revolution?
I think the beginning of the end of the revolution was maybe the day after the revolution when millions of people came to the streets and they wanted to celebrate the victory of the 1979 revolution. But then the people who came to power eventually in Iran, they started to alienate them and it started to kill different groups and different groups, they were fractured. And I think another reason for this recent protest is basically a result of an introspection by millions of Iranians who've been thinking about the historical mistake that many of them think they made in 1979. And they're reminded of that historical mistake every day through government propaganda. And when you look at the sentences of Ayatollah Khomeini, and we will have them on Iran Wire next week in English. When you look at the sentences of Ayatollah Khomeini describing the Shah's time, when he talked about poor people being ignored by the government, poor people who have no say in their own affairs. When you look at those words, the rhetoric of Ayatollah Khomeini before the revolution and during the revolution, it's as if he's talking about the Islamic Republic now.
So, Suzanne, is the Islamic Republic doomed, as your husband wrote in a Politico magazine?
I don't know if doomed is the right characterization. I do think we are at the end of an era for the Islamic Republic, one in which incremental gradualist reform is going to be a sufficient answer to the problems facing the country and its people. We just don't know what comes next.
Maziar, I want to end on a human note. I've been thinking a lot about the crackdown that, of course, the government is trying to put in place as a result of these protests and, hundreds, if not thousands of people across the country being arrested, some of whom may not have even participated in these protests. Thinking about you and that the morning that knock on the door came to your mother's apartment, what are these people going through right now?
They're going through a very difficult time. It depends who have arrested them because many different intelligence groups and security forces have arrested different people. But they're going to be tortured. They're going to be kept in solitary confinement. And I think worst of all, they are going to be tortured and coerced into confessing that they are working for Americans or the Israelis. That is the scenario that the government and the Revolutionary Guards have in mind, and they want some people to reiterate that scenario in front of television cameras.
Well, look, we talk a lot about, you know, big abstract policy questions, but I think it's important to think about what people are risking in these protests and what's going to happen to them.
And that is why they want to hear from the American government. That is why they wanted to hear in 2009, because they're risking their lives when they come to the streets and demonstrate. And the least American officials and other officials around the world can do is to support them.
Suzanne, a year from now, will there still be an Iran nuclear deal?
That's a proposition I wouldn't bet on. I think, you know, there's a certain degree of inertia in terms of keeping things in place. But the forces that came to the fore with Trump's election will have already contributed to the erosion of the U.S. commitment to the deal. And I think what's happening within Iran, as well as a reaction to the U.S. policy, is going to contribute to an erosion on the Iranian side.
My guests this week on the Global Politico are Suzanne Maloney and Mazyar Bahari. I'm incredibly grateful to both of you,
thank you
for spending
much.
This time with us. I think we're going to need to reconvene this group in a few months as events become more clear. But for now, we're right in the middle of the very first, I think, big international story of 2018. And I want to thank Suzanne, Mazyar, and, of course, all of our listeners at the Global Politico. Thank you for joining us. And you can listen to us anytime on iTunes, whatever your favorite podcast platform is. And you can email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. Thanks again.